And support for Redwood Community Radio comes from the Redwood Coast Energy Authority, which wants the community to know there are a variety of resources to help customers pay their bills, find the right rate plan, and manage their energy use during the current crisis. Visit redwoodenergy.org for complete details or call 707-269-1700 for more information. And HerbalMed RX creates organic herbal products, including bath and body oils, salves, deodorants, herbal teas, CBD products, essential oil blends, and more. Visit www.herbalmedrx.com to see all products and events. You can reach Sue Lukasha at HerbalMedRx by phone at 209-296-2120.
To KMD Gabriel 91.1 FM. This is Ask Your Herb Doctor. My name's Andrew Murray.
My name's Sarah Johannesson Murray.
For those of you who perhaps have never listened to the shows, they run the third Friday of every month from 7 till 8 p.m., and callers are invited to call in with any questions about the subject from 7:30 until the end of the show at 8 o'clock. Our guest speaker, Dr. Raymond Peet, will be joining with us, and the evening's topic here will be the continuation of the ongoing COVID infection rates across the states and across the world, and what it means to people entering this new phase of the lockdown for the winter. Dr. P, are you with us?
Yes.
Thank you for joining. Just so people can get a feel for you and for your background, would you just cover your academic and professional background for them?
First, for several years, I worked in arts, literature, linguistics, and then went to graduate school in biology from 1968 to 72 for a PhD, specializing in reproductive metabolism and aging.
Okay, and you've been a fairly prolific author. You do a monthly newsletter, and you've published many articles on your website. And I think I'm safe to say that your published works and your newsletters are fully referenced, and you're very science-based in your approach to understanding both disease and the mechanism by which things are ascertained. So the ongoing discussion that we're having with what we're being told in terms of the facts surrounding this coronavirus pandemic, nobody's spared. It seems to be a worldwide thing, with even China coming out with recent outbreaks for which they're imposing their quote-unquote draconian measures to control the spread. I wanted to carry on from where we'd left off last month. I know that the main reason for highlighting this particular infection as being an interest worldwide is because there have been deaths associated with it, and those numbers certainly have been conflated in some cases and have been skewed in other cases. And the main reason for the deaths have been what they are calling a sudden acute respiratory syndrome. So they call this virus SARS-CoV-2, and it's that same mechanism for inflammation and the watery secretions that are produced in the lungs that basically fill the lung tissue, the spaces, preventing oxygen diffusing in and out and CO2 diffusing in and out of the spaces that would normally be voids. And it is some of the rationale for last month's discussion, looking at treatment strategies. We've covered quite a few strategies that can be used if people do to unfortunately get infected. Expectorants are certainly one of those physical type strategies that have beneficial effects in terms of increasing the removal of waste from the lungs in terms of the sputum and dead cells and inflammatory byproducts. I know you'd mentioned last month a relatively old chemical called bromhexine, and wanted to bring out the fact that the airways inflammation and the hypersecretion of mucus, as well as this impaired mucociliary effect, all join together in a kind of catastrophic kind of event called the acute respiratory distress syndrome. And that is where we have, between that and the mechanical ventilator disgrace that's happened with people being put on ventilators and brought out by Carl Cameron, Sydell, and others as being tantamount to murdering people, because it's completely the wrong thing. But in the early days, they didn't know much about it. But now we know a lot more about it, and certainly, as we'll see again when we go over these numbers, the death rate from this particular coronavirus are really not very remarkable. So looking at the expectorants that we'd mentioned last month, I wanted to just mention again that licorice, in terms of licorice's active constituents, do definitely show both expectorant and antiviral activity, something not to put down too lightly, because it's a very popular herb used in many different ways for treating different conditions, and that its expectorant activity does also come with an antiviral activity. I think you had mentioned azelastine last month, and this was an antihistamine. And I know that you'd mentioned that the antihistamines, because of their anti-inflammatory activity, are very well indicated for any particular infection that is respiratory in nature, or indeed just inflammatory in nature. And so you'd mentioned azelastine, and it's also had an effect on inhibiting the SARS-CoV-2 infection in trials. I'd mentioned things like coltsfoot syrup and even onion slices made into a syrup as being useful. And then I just wanted to mention the fact about frankincense. I think that's where we got to last month. I know you're very science-based, and that you do have the support for the evidence of herbs in instances where the pharmacology of it's known, and that kind of gives you more to go on in terms of supporting any particular product, whether it's a medicine or an herb or a natural product. It's actually, when you look at the pharmacology of it, you can see things that work intrinsically in a physiological way to support the activity. And I know that a lot of the papers that have been written on frankincense talk about boswellic acid. This is a particular substance within frankincense that's known as an anti-inflammatory, and it blocks the enzyme 5-lipoxygenase. And it also promotes the formation of leukotrienes, and this leads to the inhibition of an enzyme that is responsible for inflammation. And put simply, the frankincense itself changes the inflammatory enzyme into an anti-inflammatory enzyme, so that explains some of its activity. And just looking at the death rate again at this point in time, I think the Worldometer, which is kind of, I think the John Hopkins people are fairly well advertised as the main distributors of this information, 76 million confirmed cases and 1.68 million deaths worldwide. So the 1918 comparable pandemic, the last major worldwide pandemic that had numbers of deaths that were fairly staggering, came out with a death rate of between 50, I think, and 60 or 70 million. The numbers were right around that. So 1.68 million people is a really very small number. I'm not saying it's insignificant. I'm not downplaying it. It's very sad for the people that have lost their lives. But in terms of the measures that have been taken, and this will play out in some of the questions I want to ask you later about the genomic changes of this virus and how that's being interpreted. 1.68 million people for a pandemic that spread worldwide, which I think in the early days seemed to have much higher numbers of death associated with it, and the numbers definitely have been played around with. I think that's probably the best way to say it, that when you read the facts and you look at the information, what you're seeing really needs to be looked at a lot deeper because it's very misleading. I wanted to bring out a little later on in my questioning that I read some articles about young people, and I think even in the beginning of this pandemic, they had said that really young people weren't really that affected by it. And then that's changed to the young people being the super spreaders and passing it to the older age group. But I then found another article from the CDC actually supporting that the initial finding that young people were really not very not very affected by it and were a very small portion of the population. So in terms of the people that are dying, in terms of the numbers of worldwide cases, in terms of the spread of this, what is your position still on this?
I think it was late February or early March, someone asked me what I thought was going on, and at that time I said that from all of the information about the virus infection that I could find, basically nothing is happening. And every month since then, someone has asked me a similar question, and I haven't been able to find any government announcement based on fact that convinces me that anything has happened. Naturally, there have every winter there's a pandemic, according to the World Health Organization's own definition, that a disease that makes people very sick and kills some of them, that spreads across national boundaries, affecting large numbers of people. That happens every year with influenza and cold and various variations on the coronavirus. But they've basically changed the understanding of pandemic. They've changed the definition of how to tell what a person died of. They have instructed people if they find a trace of the virus in or on the person using a test such as the PCR identifying nucleic acids, they put the death down as caused by COVID. No matter what common sense says, if they were very sick with cancer or heart disease or other lung disease, still, the death got recorded as from coronavirus, simply by order of the government. And so if you look at the actual annual death rate from lung infections, basically nothing has happened. And the only change in the annual seasonal pandemic is that it's now called COVID and diagnosed in very different ways from the way all diseases and deaths have been diagnosed previously, historically. And
so if you look at if you look at the overall overall mortality and excess mortality in the United States from January 2020 till now, are you saying that it has not changed in comparison to previous years?
When you look at the annual curve going back as long as we have data, several decades, the peculiar thing, and Denny Rancourt has gone into detail on the chart of that particular month, the second week of April of this year shows a phenomenon that just never happens statistically. That week, the incidence of influenza fell off a cliff, a vertical decrease, the very week that there was the vertical increase, spike in COVID. For that death curve to basically be a normal-looking curve, if you don't look at the names, suddenly the name of what they died of changed from influenza to COVID. And people have pointed out that similar things happened in the past when the influenza, when the polio virus came on the market. The number of people being paralyzed from something every year didn't change noticeably, but the diagnosis of polio suddenly stopped as soon as the vaccine became available, and they started being paralyzed by other things, giving a new name, new varieties of paralysis with similar symptoms appeared. And that's really an advertising principle. Change the name to make your product look really good. And the you would expect people who had been working in respiratory physiology for years and years in hospitals to really understand what influenza does to patients. And despite the fact that the some years the CDC had reported that tens of thousands of people were sick with and dying from influenza lung infections. But when they actually gave tests to look for the virus, it went down to some years of a few dozen people actually had confirmed influenza. So basically for a long time they've been saying that this annual increase in mortality in the dark, cold part of the year in the northern hemisphere, same in the southern hemisphere, they've been calling this influenza, but when they actually tested, only a small percentage was actually caused by influenza virus, another small percentage every year that they tested by coronaviruses, another small percentage by bacteria, and some by syncytial respiratory virus. But half of the cases tested, they couldn't find any microorganism that would cause the pneumonia. So the whole picture and context of what people have been dying of for decades has not been based on science. It's just noise and advertising for policies they want to institute. And you would think that the doctors, despite the government invention of influenza cases that weren't there, you would suspect that they had tried to understand what actually happens to the patient in the influenza infection. And if you look at the literature published right up to last year, but going back many years, what are the symptoms of influenza? Besides pneumonia, there are lots of symptoms. But these same experts who supposedly are experts in influenza are saying this new COVID virus is unique and horrible. It causes clotting disorders and strokes, even in children, and lung inflammation that leads to chronic permanent fibrosis of the lungs, and neurological infections that cause lingering lifelong cognitive problems, vascular damage, all of these things that they have been saying are unique and horrible about the COVID infection are classical known symptoms of influenza infection. The people are either horribly ignorant in their own profession or they're following someone's orders to mislead the public, to scare the public.
So what are these people, if you say a certain percentage, very small percentage were coronavirus, very small percentage were influenza virus and the different things that they could actually test for. So what, why were those people dying? The other half, or you said 50% of the people that died of what they labeled as influenza, what did they actually die from? Is it like an influenza-like illness and they're not sure what it was? Or
Yeah, the pneumonia. They died with pneumonia, but in at least half the cases, they couldn't identify any pathogen. It was probably stress causing endotoxin to leak out of their intestine. That always happens, and most of the known respiratory viruses, distemper in dogs, and the paralytic diseases in polio, for example, these viruses attack the intestine. That's their main site, causing inflammation in the intestine, which causes the leakage out of the hollow part of the intestine into the blood vessels of the intestine, getting it into the whole circulatory system, poisoning the system, causing inflammation of the brain, disturbance of the blood clotting system, swelling of the lungs, all of the inflammatory things, so-called cytokine storms. That's a classic of not only influenza, but the current thing, they've talked about it as a unique and horrible feature of it. But if you have, if you're very old and weak or have some major stressful sickness, the stress itself causes your intestine to become permeable, to become inflamed from the bacteria in it, and to leak the toxic endotoxin material into the whole body, causing finally systemic sepsis, multiple organ failure, and sometimes generalized intravascular coagulation, which is not only a feature of old age stress, but of both COVID and influenza. They're making something appear to be a disease, which is a condition that is almost a basic universal end-of-life condition, no matter what's killing you.
Interesting. Okay, you're listening to Ask Europe, Dr. KMED Galbo, 91.1 FM. We're joined by Dr. Raymond Peake to get his wisdom on the subject, and the number, if you're in or out the area, 707-923-3911. From 7:30 to the end of the show at 8 o'clock, callers are invited to call in with any questions. So, Dr. Peake, again, what you're reaffirming here goes hand in hand with some articles that I was looking at earlier on to form some of my questioning with you. And that one particular article, actually, I saw it in a couple of other places afterwards when I was looking back over it to see if it was actually true. It was a CBS news article by Dr. Jeremy Faust. It was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, so it's not as though it wasn't in a prestigious publication. But anyway, Dr. Faust was saying that between March the 1st and July 31st, there were significantly higher deaths amongst the younger adult population from 25 to 44 years of age, saying that the July total, and in other months too prior to July, was exceeding the young person death rate at the height of the HIV epidemic in America, and saying that actually young people were at risk and young people really should pay attention and it was a disease for young people too. And then after I'd looked at this a little bit further, I saw a CDC article, and I guess we need to look at the CDC as being a sort of authoritative mouthpiece for what happens. I think most people look at the CDC as somewhere to get their facts and their science, and they have all the data. Well, the CDC's own data confirmed that young people face a negligible risk of dying from COVID, and that actually the numbers were very, very low. So kind of plays hand in hand with what we've said all along about this and many other subjects. You've really got to be careful where you get your information from. And no doubt the public are very frightened about this. And fear, obviously, is a big motivator, unfortunately, and people make bad decisions when it's based on fear. I wanted to say this in relation to an article that I also pulled up showing that, and again, this is nonpartisan, it's just a fact, showing that there was a 6.6% gain in Obamacare health insurance plans, and that this year, 8.2 million more have been submitted just before the closing deadline of December the 15th, 2020, than in any of the preceding 4 years. So, obviously, that's a fairly significant statistic, showing that there is a certain proportion of people opting into an insurance they've never normally been part of, and quite understandably, because they've been motivated by the terrible prospects of what would happen if they were hospitalized, you know, or something along those lines. And again, not to downplay it, but just to say that the mouthpiece of the news media output is a targeted, I won't say weapon, because that kind of makes it sound like it's all one way, but it's targeted at the audience. So the deaths are regrettable. Fear is definitely a factor. The deaths are not that big. Young people have been shown not to be that affected by it. But yet, the increase in insurance is showing that that's not the case because it's a knee-jerk reaction. So, Dr. P, in terms of where we think this is all going, this is a big... Go ahead.
In relation to those articles... that's an example of how hard it is to find actual good information. People traditionally have trusted JAMA, New England Journal of Medicine, and Lancet as the outstanding sources of true medical information. But just last spring, when Trump had been talking favorably about hydroxychloroquine, right, both the New England Journal of Medicine and the Lancet published major research articles based on vast databases that no one had ever heard of before, showing that hydroxychloroquine kills people, definitely does more harm than good, based on thousands and thousands of cases, so it should have closed the matter. But then it turned out that just doing some phone calls was all it took to find out that that was totally fabricated imaginary data. The two greatest medical journals published frauds, and the editor of Lancet didn't apologize for it. He said it's not his business to tell whether something is fraudulent. It's just to publish it. The journals have been revealing who they really work for, not the doctors or the public or the patients, strictly the drug companies. And they were upset that Trump would mention a very cheap, traditional old drug that definitely has some benefit. I don't think it's at all, by a long way, the best treatment. For example, azithromycin was tested in some studies along with it, and it was hugely better than hydroxychloroquine. But the journals are not the place to look now, especially if they take medical pharmaceutical advertising. They're basically bought by the drug companies, such as the recent Pfizer announcement of the details, supposedly, about their vaccine. One of the people on the FDA committee who voted to approve the use of the vaccine without the 2-year safety test that is standard was the editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, which takes advertising money from Pfizer and published Pfizer's announcement, which actually was free of any actual useful information, and described it as a triumph. And he's not a specialist in the area anyway. He chose not to have a competent expert review the information on the vaccine, which would have revealed what a fraudulent publication Pfizer put in their magazine. But he was the gainer from the advertising, and so he put in a glowing recommendation editorial along with the article.
Again, it's caught the attention of the entire world, hasn't it, this entire pandemic? And I think probably never better time than you've got everybody's attention looking at the numbers, looking at the news reports, looking at the, you know, how well in the pipeline these new drugs are being released and how it's going to save everybody. I think, again, people have to be a little bit cautious about this because, as you've said, as has been said repeatedly, amongst the publications that have given the numbers, we're still looking at a very small, quote-unquote, terrible for those people that died. I can't overemphasize the fact that I'm not downplaying it. But that the numbers of people that have died here actually are still less than previous years from influenza. And hadn't I heard something about flu away, that the flu, the influenza reporting has disappeared.
Yeah, that's recognized by World Health Organization and the CDC. The CDC recently listed their, I think it's 54 jurisdictions, 50 states and the territories. 4 states had low incidence of influenza. The remaining 50 or so, 48 or 50, had minimal, when you look at the figures for minimal, nearly all of them are 0 cases. And this is at the start of the high incidence influenza season. And the same thing happened with the latest flu season in the southern hemisphere. Worldwide, influenza has essentially disappeared.
So I can't underestimate that. It's headline-grabbing attention that has gripped worldwide attention. It's gripped people, and unfortunately, the fear surrounding it sometimes causes people to make irrational decisions. And I would just caution people to be aware of where their information is coming from and to be aware that there are plenty of other alternatives. We'll get into looking at the genomic change of this virus and how new variants are being discovered and looked at in terms of the European infections that they're talking about as the surging infections. But we do have a caller, so let's take this caller. Caller, where are you from, and what's your question?
I'm from the East Coast. A couple of questions for Dr. Pete. One, for older people, I think you mentioned that cholesterol typically drops and it's harder to convert it to vitamin D. And I was just wondering, this is a little bit messy, but if you were trying to increase your saturated fat to PUFA ratio, if you put like cocoa butter or something that had a very small amount of poof on it all over your skin, you know, just as a hypothetical matter, obviously it's pretty greasy, but what would the impact of that be? Is that a positive?
You do absorb a moderate amount, maybe 5% or something. I read about the old traditional way the Greeks handled premature babies that were too weak to nurse. The old woman said that we just oiled them with olive oil, rolled them in a blanket, and put them behind the stove.
Right. So you're saying that generally speaking, that could be a positive.
You can really absorb a meaningful amount of saturated fat through your skin.
You say you can or cannot?
You can, yes.
You can. So you're saying so net would be a positive. Okay, so the other thing I wanted to always puzzle with is this notion of how you detect whether one is, you know, hypothyroid. And the book that I find even, the Broda Barnes book is the basic one, Unsuspected Illness is good, but the one about correlating to heart attacks is even more incredible, actually. And he goes through three different ways you actually can sort of correlate or hypothesize that someone has low thyroid. One is a low voltage on an EKG. Another one is checking the cholesterol. If your cholesterol is high, then clearly, and I've actually had this, your thyroid's not functioning properly. So that's another one. But the third one seemed interesting, and I don't think you've ever mentioned it, as far as I... And that's if young people, he indicated, who had an abnormal accumulation of mucopolysaccharides on their skin, typically had a high correlation with low thyroid function. So is there not possible? Is that true in your opinion? That's what he states sort of anecdotally. But is that something that could be checked in lieu of sort of blood tests or, you know, the less than perfect temperature check?
To determine hypothyroidism or what?
Yes.
There are lots of physical tests to estimate the quality of the skin, the amount of water and jelly in it, and so on.
But the one that I was referring to, I guess, is the abnormal accumulation of mucopolysaccharides in the skin. Is that something?
They'll go away very quickly, though, when you get the right amount of thyroid and get your body temperature and metabolic rate up.
I'm looking at more as a diagnostic tool.
What was that?
In other words, you go get your blood tests, right? And then, you know, many people say that those are just so hard to interpret, and they're just too many variables. It's just too hard to interpret.
Well,
but if you have something that's discrete... If you've
read Barnes' books, then you'll know more about how to deal with doctors who are focused away from everything meaningful, such as metabolic rate and reflexes, nerve conduction time, thought processes, and so on, and taught TSH. TSH produces inflammation and many of the symptoms that we blame on low thyroid. It's a positive action of the TSH molecule itself rather than just a negative action of lacking thyroid hormone.
Thank you. Let me just make one point on the coronavirus, two points. The CDC, all death mortality
for 2018
is about 2.8 million, and for 2020 it's also 2.8 million. This particular virus is more of a military operation. You don't die of it. It's not alive, and you have viruses in your body. So this is way bigger than the health aspects. The bigger risk is getting a test and getting a vaccine where your DNA can be changed forever, irreversibly. So I think you're focused on the wrong things. It's the vaccine and the test that should be avoided. Thanks for your time.
Okay, I think we have another caller, so let's get this next caller. Caller, you're on the air. Where are you from? What's your question?
Hi there. I'm from Northern California, and I remembered that you said something, or your guest, that there are far less deaths from the COVID vaccine than there are the influenza annually. And yet everything I have read is that it's between 24,000 and 62,000, you know, flu deaths annually. But we're way over that. So maybe off the air I'll hang up, but maybe he could explain what he's talking about.
I'm not even sure I understood your question and your numbers. I don't know if you're still on the air or not, or you...
Okay, I'll stay here. I'm saying that according to the CDC and a couple of other organizations, it's between 24,000 and 62,000 flu deaths, you know, every year, basically, for the last several years. And there's 300 and some thousand already just in this country from that. And so how can there be less...
Yeah.
I just don't understand how. Maybe you've got a source that I need to look up.
Yeah, the CDC itself is posting the absence of influenza cases this year, but in previous years, several years back, someone pointed out that they were making fraudulent claims about the tens of thousands of people dying from influenza when they hadn't tested for it. And when they did test for it, the vast majority of
Hold on, I have to stop a second. Caller, please turn off your radio. Thank you.
Yeah, we just did.
Okay, thank you. Always turn off your radio and listen on the phone. Continue, Dr. Pete. Everyone can hear you now.
The vast majority of those that the CDC had been putting down as influenza deaths, they admitted were only a very tiny fraction were actual demonstrable influenza virus infections. And so at that point, instead of saying influenza deaths, they call it ILI mortality, influenza-like illness, because most of the things that were called influenza were something absolutely not influenza. But this year, they have been checking for influenza itself and find that there's this worldwide scarcity of it.
Well, I mean, the overall mortality, Dr. Pete, you said it has not really changed this year in comparison to 2019?
Probably lower. Dr.
Pete?
Look at the total mortality year after year, it always rises very steeply from October to April, roughly, with a smooth peak, peaking in the winter in the northern hemisphere, in the dark season in the southern hemisphere. It's happening this year, except they're calling it COVID, very similar curve to what last year was called influenza. Up until April 12, they renamed the curve statistically. It suddenly changed about April 12. Influenza came to an abrupt end when COVID started, and influenza hasn't made a recovery since then.
I'm going to have to hang up and get the answers because I can hardly hear you on the phone because there's so many lines or whatever, so it's not really working for me. But I will say that also on WebMD, there's several different numbers no matter where you look. But, you know, they're basically saying the flu-related causes in the U.S. is 8,000 to 20,000 annually. And, you know, that was as of August 2020 that they put that in there. So anyway, I'm going to listen off the air because I can't really hear you on the phone. Thank you so much.
You may well be able to listen to the archive and listen to what Dr. Pete was saying also, but let me just put it out there for the moment that you're listening to Ask Europe, Dr. K. McGee-Garbable, 91.1 FM. From now until the end of the show at 8 o'clock, you're invited to call in with questions, either related or unrelated to this month's subject. The number is 707-923-3911. Dr. Pete, did you retain that thought that you had during answering that question?
What she quoted from the internet,
WebMD.
mid, whatever it was, saying that they are now calling them influenza-related diseases. The idea of you can relate anything to anything, but the CDC itself changed the terminology in a very objective way that no one objects to, calling it, instead of influenza deaths, as they had, they suddenly changed it to influenza-like illness, which is fine. You can say that the fever and the coughing and all of the inflammatory symptoms of influenza happen, even though it happens that the particular influenza virus might not be there.
Right.
So the naming is very important.
Yeah.
But regardless of whether it's influenza-like illness, COVID-19, other coronaviruses, respiratory syncytial viruses, whatever it is that causes an influenza-like illness or pneumonia, high fever, cough, regardless of all of that, if there was a new, I'm trying to repeat what you're saying, Dr. Pete, and see if I've got it right here. If there was a new novel virus that was killing so many more people than previous years, wouldn't we have an overall mortality massive increase?
It would have added to the influenza mortality, most likely. But this phenomenon is very weird. It's as if the COVID killed influenza. The very week it spiked, influenza cases collapsed. And that has never been known, where one disease will start killing people at the same rate another one was, while curing that disease.
Okay. Well, let's move on to some of the other...
And we have another caller, too.
Okay, good. Well, let's go ahead and take these callers in first. Caller, you're on the air. Where are you from? What's your question?
Hi, I'm from the East Coast, and I had a question about the best way to receive sunlight. I think you've said before, Dr. Pete, that UV radiation is good in small amounts, but can be harmful in larger amounts. And then the visible light wavelengths are good in any amount when they're coming from the sun. And that glass also filters out UV radiation. And depending on the type of glass, you can filter out the vast majority of the UV radiation. So does it make sense to spend about like maybe half an hour or so outside in direct sunlight to get your UV radiation for vitamin D, and then spend as much time outside of that during the daytime when there's sunlight behind a pane of glass as much as possible? And as a follow-up, is there any benefit to stained glass windows other than them just looking nice?
I think basically they're mentally stimulating, very, very... valuable to have in the environment, colorful, complex things in your visual field are very valuable biologically. And if you get just a little too much X or ultraviolet radiation, the harm starts resembling the damage done by ionizing radiation. It creates systemic inflammation. If you horribly sunburn your arm, for example, your whole body will feel the damage, very similar to if you x-ray an animal's foot, the whole organism goes into a particular suffocating or estrogen-like condition. So it's important not to burn yourself with the sunlight. And when you get the vitamin D building up, that is a very protective, anti-inflammatory thing. So even though you aren't very tan, the vitamin D itself protects from that spreading inflammatory process. So if you take enough vitamin D before you go into the sunlight, many people find that they tolerate the sunlight with much less tanning than normal, but no burning at all.
I see. As a really quick follow-up, is there anything to the intensity of your tan? So, for example, if you tan, if you have light skin but then become very dark, does that mean something about your vitamin D levels or anything else?
I would guess that from my experience with people who have become pretty immune to the sunlight just by getting their vitamin D in their serum a little above average, my guess is that they are being light-skinned, that they are experiencing a pretty intense inflammation that then turns on a very strong defensive tanning reaction. You can cause the tanning reaction just by injecting some toxic materials into the skin, so it's definitely the injury that the skin is reacting to.
I see. So if you do have to tan a lot,
I didn't hear.
Does that mean that you are experiencing some sort of injury? And I guess tanning is better than burning, but
I think there is undoubtedly some of that inflammation influencing other processes.
Got it. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you for your call. Engineer, is there another person on the line waiting?
Nope, it's all you.
Okay, so if anybody is listening and they want to make a quick call before 8 o'clock, the number is 707-923-3911. Dr. Pete, if we get a chance, I know you're not particularly keen on this next drug that I'm going to mention, but I wanted to just put it out there that this compound, ivermectin, has had some pretty favorable studies done on it. And just to put it out there, people want to take a look at the published research and the science. This Wurma is a treatment for river blindness in parts of subtropical Africa, South America, and generalized tropical areas where tropical parasites are well known and prevalent. River blindness is one of them. The other one that causes filariasis, which is a massive lymphadenopathy from blocking the lymphatic vessels that elephant's foot you see in Africa, parts of Africa, as well as quite a range of other parasitic infections, mainly ascaris and nematodes, etc. It's a definite treatment and used in the human population, obviously. It's also in the veterinary world as a treatment for parasitic infections of cattle and horses and chickens, etc. So ivermectin has got lots of science showing its activity against many viruses, and they quote West Nile virus, equine virus, chikungunya, HIV, HIV-1, SARS-CoV-2. They also mention its benefit in Zika, dengue, and yellow fever. They're talking about eradicating this virus, not just, kind of treatment for making it better or decreasing the effects, but they're saying that this compound can actually eradicate 99.8 or something percent of the viral DNA. It has a very strong antiviral activity, and it's used as a dewormer, probably through some different mechanisms, but they're saying it could be a novel repurposed drug, and I think there's work in the background here, and there's some of which is getting into the public about this, but I know this may or may not be a deterrence a smoke and mirrors game, because obviously the vaccine is what everything's all being told the public that it's going to be the cure. What do you think about ivermectin? I know you've mentioned other drugs, obviously losartan, which we've covered extensively as an ACE drug.
The good thing it has in its favor is that it's been used for 35 years, and it doesn't have a perfect safety record, but the vaccine has absolutely no safety record. So if you had a choice between ivermectin, preventive, and taking the vaccine, I don't see how you would have, considering your own safety, I don't see that there would be a choice. But if you're unable to get all of the other things that are known to stop the very process of the COVID development of disease, starting with the spike protein, all of our anti-inflammatory drugs from aspirin on, including even the glucocorticoids, despite their side effects, all of those. We have so many of those everywhere that has a drugstore. You can get some of those things, which have a known effect. But if you don't have those, then naturally ivermectin is a good candidate. But if you think of it out of context and think about what if 200 million people decided to get a bunch of it from their veterinarian store and take it every day preventively, then you get the chronic effects, which in some people are going to produce autoimmune joint problems, arthritis, liver reactions. Chronic hepatitis can develop from it. So very, very promising stuff in context, and taking into account that you might sometimes not be able to get all of the safer things to treat with, but it should be used for sort of an emergency situation rather than thinking of it as taking it protectively for a long time.
Okay, good. Let me hold you there, Dr. Pete. I don't mean to cut you off, but I know the credits, et cetera, need to roll. So let me thank you very much for joining us again for this last show of this year. Wish you a happy Christmas, Dr. Pete.
Okay.
Thank you, Dr. Pete. Thank you for joining us. Thank you very much for your wisdom and knowledge.
Good night.
Okay, so for those people who've listened to the show, they run Third Friday every month. Our website, westernbotanicalmedicine.com, has all of the shows up until about July of this year, July or August. The last few are going to be put up here real soon. My wife and I are both naturopathic doctors, and Dr. Peach joined us for the last 10 years doing these programs, and we've certainly learned a very different approach to a lot of the things that we were taught. Dr. Pete wants to always be on the safe side of anything, and that's quite right. So the Hippocratic Oath really does apply big time there. At first, do no harm. Okay, so for those of you who have listened, I appreciate your time. Thank you for your calls, and we hope to be doing this next year, but we'll see what the lockdown effects are like and what the COVID is doing in the states around the world, too.
My name is Sarah Johannesson Murray. Thank you for joining our program.
And my name is Andrew Murray.
Good night. Good and Merry night. Christmas.
On Tuesday, December 22nd at 8:30 p.m., KEE-TV presents the documentary Harmony in the Eel River Basin. This film looks at how we can improve the watershed and open communication about land management to keep the ecosystem alive for future generations. Get the details and stream it at keet.org. And Bryceland Vineyards is helping sponsor Food for People and KMUD Radio during the holidays. 25% of the revenue of your Bryceland Vineyards purchase will be shared with KMUD and Food for People. In these times, we all need community, clarity, and nourishment. To contribute, email Rosie or Andrew at brycelandvineyards.com or call 707-923-2429 to place your contactless order. Wine can be picked up in Bryceland, Redway, or Eureka. Bryceland Vineyards is proud of its long-standing support of important local organizations. Think globally, drink locally. And we are Redwood Community Radio, KMUD Garberville, KMUE Eureka, KLAI Laytonville. In just 30-odd seconds, we will have Shaka and Shyla stepping out on A Wing and a Prayer.